Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson. And today we are continuing the series, Tomes of Magic, and we are discussing the Fragile Path Testament of the First Cabal. And the first thing you may notice, dear listener, is I am not Adam J. Simpson. And today, as my assistant and co-pilot and more or less pilot, because in general, he knows vastly more about the system and setting than I do, is one Victor Kinzer. Victor, thank you for your help. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me. Always thrilled to talk about anything from the Renaissance.
So the Fragile Path, Testament of the First Cabal, is part of, I guess you could say, a series of books that exist across the old world of darkness where we get a in-universe or in-world item. The Testament of the First Cabal was written by Porthos Fitzpercato, Fitz Empress, and purports to take down the testament of whatever memory people had of the First Cabal. Victor, what was the First Cabal?
So the First Cabal was really the first group of mages who were representatives of the nine mystic traditions. Background, which they give at the beginning of the book in the introduction, is that the Order of Reason had been founded, and the Order of Reason was the precursor to the modern technocracy. And they were founded to bring reason and light into the world and make the world safe for humanity, even at the expense of the rights of other things to exist that maybe made the world less safe for humanity. And a bunch of mages said, hey, we don't like that, partially because if you go back, the mystics had a lot of power previously, especially going back to the Dark Ages, and part of the Order of Reason's original plan before things got all corrupt, as they are prone to do, was to take those, you know, hermetics and celestial masters down a notch or two so that, you know, the celestial chorus down a notch or two so that they weren't victimizing humanity anymore. And of course, the mystics didn't like that. As we all know, the Order of Reason got a little bit out of hand, and it went from just, you know, mitigating threats to controlling everything. So there's an argument to be made that the mystics were right and they saw that coming. And so a couple of the groups went around the world and got as many different mages representing as many different organizations as possible. Some of the organizations are a little bit hard to wrap your head around, like the Dream Speakers. We went to the New World and we found spiritual workers, and they were part of this thing called the Dream Speakers. Doesn't necessarily work that way, but...
To go slightly out of order, the thing I like about it is they follow the path of the Wick to get to the New World. And they're like, hey, we got this shiznit that's going down in a couple of years. You should join. And the delegation that represents the Dream Speaker, Walking Hawk, has to fucking canoe. Like, what kind of bullshit is that? Someone's like, I had a loon spirit take me across the Umbra to reach a new continent. He's like, okay, you can take the bus back. Sometime in the 1440s, the Hermetics, the Carros de l'Est, however the heck the Celestial Chorus in vague French is pronounced, and their verbena get together and are like, this technocracy thing, what about it? And they're like, we should do some shit. And they're like, yup. So in 1457, the Grand Convocation is called, and nine traditions are formed, and they argue for 9 years, and they pick nine representatives to go out into the world and to do good stuff. The leader of this group is Hallel Tayaman, who is a Solificati, who is a merger of two people who goes back and forth. And I think one of the most interesting things about this, and it is only indirectly shared, is that the opening of the book is a invocation by Porthos Fitzempress, who says, the problem is we are not remembering our past. It is this thing that is saying we are winning the war, but we are losing the world, which I don't know about you. I don't think they're winning the war or the world when it comes to the traditions. And then it goes through and Porthos talks about the background of it. And Porthos talks about meeting Hillel and how in awe of their charisma Porthos is. And I feel like that's that thing where in Star Trek Next Generation, the security officer Worf, the big burly Klingon, has to get beaten up a lot. That way the audience knows how strong the bad guy is, where they're like, oh man, they beat up the Klingon. And this is a case where like the most powerful mage that we will ever know, Porthos Fitzempress, is looking at Hallel and is like, wow, look at that, John. And I feel like that was kind of a setup to be like, this is how charismatic and amazing this individual is.
Yeah, I think it was partially a setup for that. I think it was also a setup to humanize Porthos a little bit, because at that time when he would have met Halel, he wasn't the grand archmage that we all know him as in, you know, the pre-Reckoning storyline. He was pretty young and powerful, but not as powerful as anyone who was chosen for the first Cabal at that point in time. And the players really loved the power of the key characters that were introduced early on in Mage. So I also kind of think it's that moment of, let's take this opportunity to present this character when they were just human. Because if a plain human mage, but like a normal powered mage, can become Porthos Fitz Empress, then so can your PCs.
I like that as a setup, as opposed to the way I took it, where it was great. Now we're getting the prequels to the original trilogy of Star Wars. So our rough timeline is the Cabal at the Mistridge Covenant is destroyed by the Craft Masons, the early technocrats, which unites the Order of Reason. That happens in the winter of 1210. The Covenant of the White Tower is signed, which is this agreement among the Craft Masons to form the Order of Reason, or among the Craft Masons and other nascent, what would later become conventions, to form the Order of Reason. And in 1330, the Ascension War by general agreement begins. In 1440, we have this process where people are going around saying, hey, we need to do something about this. Calls are sent out to the corners of the earth. And starting in 1457, the Grand Convocation occurs, and it ends with 1466 with this, we're going to send people out into the wilds to do good stuff and to counteract the actions of the Order of Reason. And shortly after we get that timeline, we get two additional documents. We get the resolutions of intent of the Council of Nine Mystic Traditions. And it goes through and it says, this is what we're doing. This is why we're doing this. And then immediately after that, we get the Declaration of the Ivory Tower, which I don't know if it appears anywhere else, does it?
Not that I'm aware of. I think actually this might be the only book that has either of the two founding documents of both the Order of Reason and the Traditions. Yeah, the Resolution of Intent of the Council of Nine Mystic Traditions and the Declaration of the Ivory Tower right next to each other. And I think this is the only book that they appear in this complete form.
And the two things that struck me immediately, one, the Declaration of the Ivory Tower is created in a period of weeks. And then the statement of intent from the nascent Council of the Nine Mystical Traditions takes 9 years to iron out. The text makes reference to thousands of mages in Horizon, which kind of suggests that there were a lot of mages running around in different forms. Like, we're not told that it's thousands of people. It's very specifically thousands of wheel workers. There's a lot of mages running around, and it kind of lends an idea that there used to be more, and in more contemporary society that maybe mages have become this rarer thing. So the other thing that happens is this thing goes out and the group is betrayed by Halel, who eventually gains the appellation of Abomination. Four people are killed in addition to Halel, who receives Gilgul and death. And four people are left to leave some sort of testament. So Porthos goes through and recounts all the information that Porthos was able to gather about the four that fell in battle, what they were like, what their relationship among the first Cabal was. And then the book launches into the memoriam and the records of those who were not killed when Halel betrayed the group. Now, the question is, why did Halel do that? You want to take that one, Victor?
Yeah, the question of why Halel did that is kind of the crux of the whole story. One of the things that I think is worth pointing out, and I think this is just the nature of the book mostly being the writings of the people who survived, is I always felt like there are much richer relationships between the mages who survived and Halel. They're kind of the central characters. The members of the Cabal who fell almost felt like to me like they played secondary roles in the narrative. It's not always the case, but it seemed to be a trend. What happened, though, in terms of the betrayal, and I'll put betrayal in quotes because Halel insists that what he did was not a betrayal, and he makes a weirdly compelling case, is the Cabal goes out into the world to, you know, spread mysticism, to find other mages, to take part in the mission, to fight against the Order of Reason. And it's all very noble, and it doesn't really work out very well. These are mages with dramatically different paradigms, some of them painfully different paradigms, and they bicker and they fight. And even in the face of all of the terrible things that the Order of Reason is doing, and I will say the Order of Reason and Fragile Path, which was written before Sorcerer's Crusade came out, reads a little bit more like the technocracy than the Order of Reason that was eventually fully fleshed out in Sorcerer's Crusade. There are lots of little canon things in this book that will seem out of place because they were changed by later writing. But ultimately, the Cabal just kind of falls apart and is constantly trying to pull itself back together. And Halel just finally goes, we can't operate this way. The traditions will fail. The Order of Reason will win. And he tries to tell everyone this, and he tries, well, the book refers to Halel with male pronouns, not actually appropriate. They try to bring the Cabal together from the reading, well over a year after things start to go south. And eventually Halel goes, all right, well, I need to fix the traditions. They need to come together. And so he tells Gabrielites, who are in this presented as the precursors of the NWO. If you later read Sorcerer's Crusade, they are a hyper-fanatical religious convention within the Order of Reason. The path to NWO is winding and incomplete, but that's the way they're presented in Fragile Path. And he feeds them information about where the Cabal will be. He does that specifically so the Nine Traditions, the Council, will turn on him and have a unifying force. He sort of knows he's sacrificing himself in that, or at least that's the way I always read it. But he hopes that the Council's rage over having their first Cabal wiped out or severely damaged will be focused enough on the Order of Reason to unite the Nine Mystic Traditions. And when he's brought up on trial, he says, you know, this is my reasoning. We have to come together. This was worth the sacrifice. It was a horrible, horrible choice for me to make. I'm not a Nefandi, which is what he's accused of. You just pushed me to this because you're all so dysfunctional. And they go, nope, Nefandi, rip his avatars out. Clearly the Soul of Akkadi have forged a monster by creating you. They are unified in vision just long enough to destroy him. And then they fall to bickering again. And in the canon, the Nine Traditions are basically a completely ineffectual organization, until the Ali Bateen finally get fed up with them and leave, and they don't really get their act together till the 20th century. So more or less, you know, the canon points to Halel was right, which is a hard thing for some people to swallow given what he did.
Yeah, Halel at least wasn't wrong. And it's one of those things where it took me a while to realize the idea that this was supposed to be kind of all the traditions in microcosm, that each person is considered a paragon of their group. Normally, when we have people around a table, you're going to have maybe quirky characters that don't perfectly embody the group that they represent, and maybe that allows them to get along with paradigms that are kind of outside of their magical purview, and that makes it work. But it is very important to the structure of this that each of the members be an embodiment, supposedly, of what each tradition is going to represent, and the bickering and the infighting that is going to cause. So even though they are able to make a few strides, it's not very effective, to say the least. And it's kind of interesting. Like, it's the Council of the Nine Mystic Traditions, and by 1506, so less than 40 years after the formation of the Council, the Solificati have left. And for four centuries, it is the Council of the Eight Mystical Traditions until the Electrodyne Engineers / Sons of Aether join. And then they're together as a grand force for maybe 20 years before the Ali Bateen disappear. And then it's another 40 or 50 years before we get the Virtual Adepts back. So for around 10% of the lifetime of the Council of the Nine Mystic Traditions, about 20% of the council, the time of the Council of the Nine Mystical Traditions, do we actually have nine traditions?
You know, one thing I was thinking when you talked about how the Order of Reason came together in a week. And
yeah, it was like a 3-day weekend. Like, there was an agenda. Someone was assigned. Like, the stupid thing that happens in elementary school where they're like, one person in your group has to be the person that keeps everyone on task. And you're like, that's a stupid role. And then you become an adult and you realize, no, that is why that person makes all the money or should. Anyway, sorry for interrupting.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're not wrong. And who's going to be good at that? Technocrats. Uh-huh. But, you know, the traditions spend nine long, miserable years basically agreeing to, we don't like the Order of Reason. I mean, that's more or less what it comes down to. And that really sums up why the technocracy does so well compared to the traditions in most time periods and most settings. Like, just that one little statistic, blow it up to the entire narrative, and you get a pretty accurate representation of these groups.
So let's do a quick rundown of who was in the first cabal. One was Fallbreeze, a East Asian representative of the Akashic Brotherhood, a female practitioner of martial arts, and a martial character that in the final battle, there's the pile of bodies left around her as she makes her last stand. Always referred to herself as a brother of the Akashic Brotherhood, which I thought was interesting. Next, we have Cygnus Morrow from the Euthanatoi, a half Greek, half Libyan, a former slave who awakens. This is one of the best awakening things. So the note I have to myself was, bestie of Porthos awoke to fucking Kali. So like, he awakens to the thought of him having sex with the goddess of death. Yeah. That's one way to know you're a Euthanatos. There's very little ambiguity there.
It's true. The other thing I find really interesting about Cygnus is the tradition of death was always split between the Euthanatos and the Chakravanti. And the Euthanatos were Greek and the Chakravanti were Indian. And the implication is their paradigms are strongly aligned. They do a lot of the same things. Once there was travel, they kind of ended up with relationships with each other and sort of merged into a single tradition, but they had very distinct origins. And then here's this guy who's Greek, and he was in India, and he awakes to, you know, this vision of an Indian goddess of death. And it's like, okay, I know in reality, these are two different lineages, but can we somehow shove them into a single character? Can we do it? And I kind of feel like he's just a thought experiment along those lines.
Yeah, I can get behind that. And there's weird notes about his rather modern promiscuity. I don't know about you, but whenever I read anything in mage history outside of this book, I just kind of assume that everyone is kind of boning everyone else unless it's stated otherwise. And that comes up a few times.
I don't know. I feel like that was a common trope in the 90s that like, oh, now we have more egalitarian ideas about sex because for some reason Americans all thought that, oh, because we've come forward from the 50s, if you go back farther, it must be even more conservative. And as it turns out, not really. Humans like fucking.
Oh, yeah. I mean, especially when you spend a couple centuries basically just being a wheat farmer, there's not a lot else to do. And it's also interesting because it's one of those cases where it's like, he was beautiful and could seduce everyone, but everyone still got the heebie-jeebies from him. Like, uh-huh, that's my Euthanatoi friends. So I'm glad that was there. The next character we get is the Hermetic Master, Master Louis Dumont. He is from House Quaesator, who are the judges. And he was added because it's like, okay, Hillel is super charismatic and everyone will just follow along what Hillel says. So we're going to send a stuck-up stick in the mud to be their counterpart. And you're like, I don't know if that's going to work in the grand scheme of things. But turns out he was super fun to be around comparatively for an Order of Hermes. I don't know if like the most fun hermetic is one of those things that like saying I'm the world champion at chugging Zima.
I do think there's a little bit of a connection there between claiming you're the most charismatic hermetic is maybe not something you should advertise. The other thing, I kind of love Master Louis Dumont, and I kind of love him because, again, he played sort of second fiddle in a lot of ways. He wasn't central to any of the major relationships or drama that happened. But the thing that stuck with me when I first read this book is there's a little snippet in it about how he started moaning and complaining about halfway through the trip. And this is when Hillel is in the process of getting frustrated with everyone. And like, oh, maybe we should just join the Order of Reason. And I read that and I was like, wait, what the hell did I just read? And I was talking with some friends and they were like, oh no, back at that time, the Order of Reason and the Hermetics weren't as dramatically different. The Craft Masons actually broke off. They used to be a house of the Hermetics. And so the idea that like the paragons of magic in the modern era are only really paragons of magic because they didn't change that much and the world modernized around them. And at one time, they sort of seriously thought about defecting because that whole paragon of your tradition, that was a thing that the Hermetics considered broadly for a while. That reframed a lot of things for me. And I liked that there was that little breadcrumb for me to follow with this character.
And the other thing that's interesting about him that strikes me is, one, it's a hermetic practitioner that is not bound to, let's say, contrivance. Like, the book makes special note of the fact that the Hermetic Master traveled relatively light, which is not in my head the stereotype I necessarily have of Hermetic. And the other thing is, as you mentioned, that like, oh, all of these ideas were new. Like the whole theme of Sorcerer's Crusade, which I admittedly have very little experience with, is everything is new and fresh and exciting. And the factions that we play in modern day who have been at each other's throats for half a millennia, sometimes you could squint, not quite tell the difference between the two.
Yeah, it's true. When Fragile Path was written, which again was before Sorcerer's Crusade, they were more antagonistic. This really emphasizes the tension. But once you get into Sorcerer's Crusade and you open up the Order of Reason book, there's a lot of, yeah, I mean, the Daedalans and the traditions didn't necessarily like each other, but most of the fighting was a bunch of chest thumping, except for the Gabrielites, who were dicks and actually wanted to kill everyone.
Well, the Gabrielites were the ones, they weren't even invited to the convention of the Ivory Tower, correct? They just kind of arrived.
No, and I don't think that was planned when Fragile Path was written, because the Order of Reason book where that tidbit is in is developed by someone other than Phil. That was developed after he had left White Wolf. So I think that was a little bit of making sense of what had come before, but I personally think it's fantastic. I think it makes the time period and the setting work a lot more elegantly.
I like it because it also creates this interesting religious element to the technocracy that a storyteller can choose to or to not lean into, in saying that the familiarity between the New World Order and between the Celestial Chorus, especially if you look at certain Christian traditions like the Jesuits, if you remove the titles from it and you did a true description of both, you could not necessarily know which one were which.
Yeah, and that even comes up, like when you look at Dark Ages Mage and when you look at a lot of the technocratic critiques of the traditions, or I'll say critiques of the traditions, critiques of them, where they're like, oh, don't give us that line that we're domineering. Let's talk about what the Choir Celeste did in the Dark Ages, because you have no cover. And I personally really like leaning into that. I don't like treating the traditions like good guys.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting thing, and which makes me kind of curious to see where the Disparate Alliance goes. I also have an interpretation, this is kind of a side jag, that the Disparate Alliance in M20 represents the paradigms that refused to give in to the pull of postmodernism. But I don't actually, that's one of those statements that sounds good as a sentence, but I don't necessarily know if I can support it factually yet, but it's an idea and the Storyteller Vault beckons to me.
Yeah, I do like that idea, but I feel like that's a whole rabbit hole.
So this will probably get cut in post. So the next person we talk about is the Daud Ala Abu Hisham Ibn Mukla al-Baghdadi, who, of the members of the first cabal, had been around the longest. So at the time this occurs, this person had been walking the earth for at least 4 centuries and is skilled in dozens of weapons and carries all of them around and has this interesting interaction with Sister Bernadette, where he is this learned figure who is familiar with scripture and the Quran and early Christian and Jewish teachings. And Bernadette, the representative from the Celestial Chorus, is illiterate and does not believe that it is important to go to scripture because the belief is true unto itself. So we have this fascinating to me case of someone who has a very simple, unadorned musical belief scheme, and this other character who is like, no, this is what your texts actually say. And the true believer considers it almost heretical to invoke the word of God in such way, which I just found one of kind of the sub themes that was magical to me. And again, this character is kind of a hanger on, doesn't really get a huge amount of development. And I don't know if this came across to every reader, but like everyone in the first cabal is like a smokehouse in terms of attractiveness. And as I'm fond of pointing out, it's the world of darkness, but at least everyone is sexy. So you got that going for you. And that rounds out those who didn't make it. Do you have any thoughts on those who died?
Yeah, the one other thing I'd say, you know, while we've said they sort of play a second part in the narrative, especially for the Batini, reading through the way this character was described did wonders for me understanding how you would actually play a Batini. I think that reading this book, if nothing else, gives you a really good set of little tidbits about paradigm. And I do really like the way they describe paradigm in practice for all the characters, even the ones that got a little bit less screen time, as it were.
it suggests to me that there is a notion of magical progress over time. During the final battle, Walking Hawk mentions that Falbreeze dies in his arms and he does not have the time to return to his dwelling to fetch his medicine to do anything. And any modern player would be like, fast casting, minus one additional for doing it without a focus. You could totally power through it. Jeez, what's your problem? And I kind of use that as a justification of, no, the process of magic does still evolve over the next 5 centuries. Or we can just say that the books aren't internally consistent between theme and setting, and both of those are perfectly valid.
I would agree with that. Another area where that jumped out at me along those lines is in the opening where they were talking about Horizon. In Fragile Path, they're talking about Horizon Realms. But when you get to Sorcerer's Crusade, there aren't really Horizon Realms yet. Mages haven't really figured out how to traverse this Umbra thing because the Umbra is new. If you go back only, I think at that point, a few hundred years, spirit and the physical world were a lot more intermingled. And even a few hundred years before the Dark Ages, and there really wasn't much of a boundary at all once you get like pre-Roman. And so I liked that even though they did mention a Horizon Realm and Fragile Path, they eventually pulled back and said, yeah, all these crazy things you do as spirit, Sorcerer's Crusade mages won't know how to do that. They can walk out into the spirit wilds, and the spirit wilds are this crazy thing that they're just figuring out how to engage with. And it makes playing a Celestial Master or even a dream speaker exciting in a different sort of way. Like, what if things played out differently?
Uh-huh. And the one that always impressed me was between editions, like the Shard Realms and Shade Realms change what planet they're associated with. And what is it? Prime moves from Luna to the Earth. And like, I picture there being a meeting of like the Celestines. They're like, right, we got enough moles in one face. They're throwing the weight around. Moon, sorry, you've been relegated to the minor leagues. The werewolves are still going to like you, though. And like, there's just this meeting of Celestines where they rehash and like they have to pack their bags and move back to Earth or something like that. But yeah, it's interesting going back to a time when the practices and the Umbra were not quite set yet. And then we move into the section where we get the testaments or the records of those who did not die during the betrayal. And this is where the big narrative guns come out. The first one we get is the Solificato. So Halel, Theoman, Theobath. So we get the last statement that Halel leaves before Gil-Gul is delivered. Halel gives this stirring invective that says, hey, I had to do this. If you do not see the errors of what you are doing, we are all absolutely boned. And it is presented in a form where we get a lot of beautiful illustration, or at least I thought they were quite good, of what happened during the betrayal. The tale that Halel lays is kind of reiterated by the rest of the book, so I don't really feel a strong need to dwell on it now. We get a little bit of reflection from Porthos of, was Halel right? And as Victor said at the beginning, Halel is brought up on accusations of being a Diabolist, and we have no proof of that whatsoever. And even Halel's like, that's bullshit, you know it, but okay, you need to kill me anyway, and just kind of goes, and everyone is just angry at Halel for pointing that out and being so right.
Yeah, I really like his testament. Like you said, it kind of overlaps with the story that's told throughout the rest of the book. I find Halel to be a fascinating figure because on one hand, he's standing there telling the council, this is what's wrong with you. And all signs point to his assessment. His diagnosis is accurate. Not quite sure he prescribed the right medicine, though. Yeah. What I find really interesting about him is he is the perfect example of hubris before the fall. Like on one hand, yeah, you're right in terms of what got you here, but what in the world made you think this was going to work out? These people who are so fractured aren't going to unify around the person you want to make them angry at when they're so busy being unified around hating you. And then once you're dead, that hate feels satisfied. Like, this is not a path forward, and it's obviously not a path forward, but that's so very mage. Like, I'm incredibly powerful and I can make the thing happen right now. So I'm going to do it right now. But that doesn't mean that that's actually the right way to do it. So I find his testament is just to me, the embodiment of being a mage.
Yeah, there's a couple of really choice lines where Halel just kind of screams at everyone. And I like it. At one point, Halel says, where is your courage? And at another point, Halel says, "You have dismissed the lesser crafts as unworthy of your consideration, sneering in contempt of their narrow views, brushing aside your potential allies in the battle for ascension. Is this then the measure of your wisdom? How dare you judge those who walk a different path when you can no longer even find the road yourself?" And I just wanted to be like, burn! Like, I wish this had been laid down in the form of like a slam poetry contest rather than it being the precursor to Gil Ghul.
Oh my God, but Halo slam poetry could totally be a storyteller's vault project.
Someone make it happen. I will gladly buy it. The next one we get is the Remembrances of Eloine. Eloine? Do you have any idea how to pronounce that?
I don't. I've always pronounced it Eloine, but I do not know that that is correct.
And we get the story of Eloine waiting to be killed by the Inquisition. So after the events of the betrayal, Eloine escapes from imprisonment during a daring raid, and then spends the next 230 years or so just tooling around Europe trying to prevent pagans from being killed. During the adventures of the First Cabal, she mothers twins who we don't quite know the fate of, and we don't quite find out their fate until we get literally the last mage book before M20. And we get an interesting line where Eloine says, "I straddled his hips and felt this alien being enter me." I don't know about you, but that got my motor running. And you're like, oh, okay. Glad it was love. And there's a suggestion beforehand where she's like, "I felt a strange compulsion to be with him." And this is one of those cases where, like, I feel super uncomfortable that mages have access to the mind sphere. And I'm wondering, like,
Well, yeah, and I think that's why mind was pretty severely reined in M20, because many players use mind the way it's implied it's being used here. So I'll be honest, I did not follow the late revised books very closely. I've used the twins. I really like them being a question mark, just a full question mark. I like them being out there for people to use. Because for me, the implication that Eloine was sort of manipulated into getting together with Halel, and the nature of Halel as an alchemical creation, he is himself, or they are themselves, a working, to me points to the fact that the working may not have been complete. I like to think of the twins as the actual culmination of that biospiritual alchemical experiment.
The big thing that came across to me in this section is how utterly broken these young characters who had a dream about how well things could go. And I feel like if this were proper World of Darkness, a fair number of these characters would have just picked themselves up, dusted themselves off, and like gotten right back out into the game. Like, I don't know about you, but being like abducted by technomancers, being tortured for a couple of years, and then having like a sudden escape, I feel like that's a pretty common plot line in like pre-apocalyptic punk goth mage chronicle. You had made mention of the fact that you like using the twins. And the thing I like about the twins is, since mage has so few named characters compared to like werewolf or vampire, there's not a lot of easy ways to tie your characters into the notion of like destiny and greatness in mage and the mage world. And the twins are some of the few cases where you can do that, where there is this question mark of what happened to them. And you have the glory of avatars, where they, even though it's four centuries later, you can have the avatar and justify having four or five dots of destiny. Are there any other like little things like that that you've jammed into games?
I tend not to do like the crazy high avatar thing. I do try to pull things from canon, from the plot. The time I used the twins, I sort of merged together the mage story about Autocathon and the Ananasi story about Mother Ananasa being torn off from Weaver because Weaver wanted to create something new and her own. Not that ripping off your abdomen to create a daughter is really doing that, but, you know, Weaver's a little delusional. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting if that was just a metaphor for some part of Autocathon being broken off, and that both of these things are true, but through a different narrative lens. And so I like taking ideas like that and saying, okay, players, you all know how this will play out because you know what the modern World of Darkness looks like, but can you do a large enough cosmological working? Can you engage with these forces socially, magically, however, in a way that pushes things in a different direction and giving people an opportunity to do that. Obviously, time period games are better for that approach, but I like to pull in a lot of very high-flying plot and try to drag it down to a point where the players feel like they can engage with it.
Where I, on the other hand, did a plot line where characters met a single vampire and everyone's where Victor is running something where it's like, you have to change the very Umbrascape. Once again, proof that I am a bad storyteller and I should stick to doing a podcast. But the rest of the section on Eloine is kind of just her complaining. Like, I don't think it paints her in a very positive light, especially in light of all the other characters who are like, oh, we were drawn to her. And when you kind of have that kind of hollow character representation tied with everyone being drawn to her, where it just kind of seems like she's like the princess to be rescued or just kind of this hottie in turmoil whose main job is to mate with Halel and bang out two twins. It left me wanting.
Yeah, I can't say that's an unfair evaluation. I mean, I kind of get that she was, I think, if not the youngest, one of the youngest members of the Cabal, and she was supposed to kind of represent naivete. But yeah, it's one of the weaker aspects of the narrative.
And then next we get to what may be my favorite section, at least cognitively. We get the Song of Bernadette. So Sister Bernadette starts out being absolutely dirt poor and grows up in the same town or near the same town as Joan of Arc and is like, I'll never do anything important with my life. Smash cut to the fact that she then lives like another 4.5 centuries or something like that, becomes one of the most potent choristers ever to have existed. And the memoir we get is the Song of Bernadette, which is this large choral work that Sister Bernadette lays down on or before her deathbed. And it's this sprawling musical work done in this particular French form known as the motet, which is interesting because Sister Bernadette had sufficient mastery of spheres plus what is probably dissociative identity disorder, what we would commonly refer to as having multiple personalities. So when Sister Bernadette came up with a 4-part harmony, she could sing all 4 parts by making additional copies of herself, which I love as an idea. And you're like, oh, that's pretty great. And then they're like, oh, by the way, dissociative identity disorder. I'm like, okay, that just got next level. So the 2 times we actually see that kind of co-location occur within canon is Sister Bernadette. And it's also mentioned that it's a normal tactic of the Marauders. So you're like, oh, okay, well, that's a good thing to know. And this long musical work is punctuated with footnotes that explain the references that are being made in the music. And rather than it being a traditional 4-part harmony, each voice is actually singing a different melody. So you kind of have to go through it a bunch of times if you want to get the full story of Sister Bernadette's life and Sister Bernadette's interpretation of what is happening. I like this section. I like the idea of this section just because it's a 140-page book or something and not everything needs to be like dense setting information. This kind of aside that is this musically beautiful story I found quite compelling. And if all works out well, my housemate, who is a skilled pianist and we have a baby grand in the house, will hopefully lay down a track on it. We'll see if that happens.
Yeah, I also really love this section because, you know, all the times I've played mage, people generally play functional characters because it's really hard to role play a completely alien entity. And Bernadette, because of the dissociative identity and the singing constantly, I mean, her chapter is expressed in this very complicated multi-character song, but there are also descriptions through the book that she communicated often by singing. Like, her paradigm was sort of all-consuming. And that's kind of common for mages. You know, when you study a lot of, you know, people who took part in magical traditions in the real world, there is the idea of the magician's madness. And this is a little different from that when you hear that term. That tends to be referring to kind of hermetic things. But it's kind of interesting in mage, and it kind of doesn't get addressed a lot in play because it's so hard to role play. But that idea that you've become so much more aware of the way reality works, that it isn't that you're broken mad, it's just that you work in a way no one else does, and so they can't relate to you anymore, and that will be perceived as madness. And I feel like this chapter does a better job of capturing what that actually means without fish-mouthing it than probably any other example I can think of in Mage.
I am literally a member of an opera company, and I would find this person utterly insufferable. That would just drive me nuts. The idea that it's one of those things where you would call a person like this mad if they didn't have the ability to bend reality. So obviously, from their point of view, it works. So who are we to call them crazy? And just as a note to the readers, Fishmalk is a term of art that popped up, I think, from one of the Dark Ages books, which depicts a Malkavian literally talking to a fish while a soldier-esque person with a helmet on is bleeding in their underwear. So sometimes when we just talk about crazy for the sake of crazy, we use the term of art Fishmalk. And I totally understand that. The penultimate one we get, and what I think is probably my favorite section, is we get the revelation of Akrites Salonicus. And the thing that I thought was interesting was Akrites takes the betrayal very personally. And not until I read this did I realize why. Like, you have access to the time sphere. You are a seer of Kronos. Your goal is to see this shit coming, and you didn't. And that would bother the dickens out of me if I were that person in the book. And it lays out this story of the group actually on a mission, which I loved. They are somewhere in the high Arctic. They are trying to track down a mage to get some information. There's a misunderstanding of what they're there to do. The character they encounter thinks they're being accused of diabolism or some untoward dealing, when in actuality, they're looking for something else. And in the process, Akrites falls into this like demented dream state. At one point, awakens during that while being cared for by this other mage, and Hillel grabs this other mage by the arm, and seemingly centuries pass at Akrites' touch in what is a very severe manifestation of the scourge or paradox at the time. And I very much like this section because it gave you a glimpse of the day-to-day life of what the group had to go through. The fact that, sure, some people have access to correspondence, but by and large, whenever they're going somewhere, they're hoofing it. And we also get the revelation of Akrites, where Akrites reveals that at some point in the future, that the traditions and the order of reason are going to be merged, and Hillel will rule over them, and the world will be ground under by the forces of stasis. And I like a well-done prophecy as much as the next person, and I thought it was pretty well done.
A prophecy is weird in Mage because it's hard to nail down where the world's going to go. Like, the whole purpose of Mage is you have no idea. You could change it. You could do whatever you want. But that's kind of what Freddy's story is all about, is you can see the future. You can use the time sphere, but it's never quite what you imagine it to be until you look back on it. It's the seer's curse, not quite Cassandra syndrome, the other version of it. Not that no one believes, but they know you're right. But the way you interpret it is flexible. And so having a prediction like that, I think, grew out of the fact that the world of darkness was so very eschatological when this book came out and everything was about the end times. And now a lot of players have kind of gone, oh, well, that wasn't sustainable. Let's maybe not focus on that. So I don't know. I guess my head's kind of tinkling with, what do you do with that story now?
It kind of reminds me of what happened in Vampire. And then Beckett's Jihad Diary comes out, and you essentially have a line that says, like, Gehenna was the friends we made along the way, or Gehenna, it was inside of us all along. And you're like, okay. The other thing that I thought was interesting about this section is it has this delicious little bit where there is mention of the time barrier that the technocracy created. And I am so glad. Yeah, I am so glad that this exists. Is that formalized anywhere within Sorcerer's Crusade? Like, I don't recall that being in any of the books I've read so far otherwise.
It's not. There are things that I cannot say about that because I...
Oh, shut up.
Yes. No. So that time barrier is one of my favorite things in the world, and I have a personal opinion about what caused it, but I don't know for certain what caused it in the canon. Maybe later we might know.
Yeah. I do like the idea in the world of darkness, and this is a plot point I've decided to toy around with, that there are these very large spells that kind of prevent the world from getting too off of its axis, as it were. And one of the ones I have is, I work with the assumption that there is a technocratic group that more or less protects the world mortal leaders from infiltration from other supernaturals. to prevent a president from being affected by presence or dominate of a vampire, or to prevent a major business leader from becoming enchanted by the Fae. And I like to think that there are these large magic works that maybe during a rare moment when the technocracy and the traditions work together, wove these great things. And I'd like to think that that's one of them. That, okay, the Ascension War is on, but maybe there was this multi-century period where it was kind of this gentleman's war, where everyone kind of agreed to the rules, and one of them was don't dick with heads of state, and another one was don't dick with the time barrier. But I guess we'll find out more later. Thanks.
We'll see. I don't know for certain about where that will go, but I will just point out that time barrier is described, if I'm remembering it correctly, I haven't read that part too recently, but it's described as showing up somewhere around the reorganization, like basically preventing anyone from the past from peering through at what would become the Technocratic Union and the grand reorganization of Victoria, possibly also of Albert. Probably Albert as well. But interesting things were happening in the world related to time during that period in history. Mage canon aside. So, yeah, if you go digging, there's some really interesting story hooks there.
Yeah. So Acrites lays down this prophecy. There are attempts to interpret it. And I liked Victor's comment that the problem with prophecy is not that you know it, but that you only ever truly know it in retrospect, that it's a gift that only reveals itself when it is too late. And again, we get a lot of pictures of people that are very attractive, much more than they had any business being if they were schlepping it around in the mud of the 15th century. The final section we get is the Oratory of Walking Hawk. And as I mentioned earlier, that some verbena master uses the Pass of the Wick to pop over to North America and says, yo, this thing's going to happen. Then Walking Hawk, this reformed warrior, now medicine person, gets this vision that Walking Hawk needs to cross the ocean, loads up a canoe next to a canoe, and then just paddles to Europe and lands aground on France, torn, battered, and bruised, and is received by a nascent dream speaker who helps Walking Hawk make it to the Grand Convocation. I like the fact that Walking Hawk provides an outsider's view of what the world of European magic and magic from the Levant and from Asia would have looked like to someone who thought those practices were completely alien, and using relatively simple language talks about this is what it looked like to me. I think it serves a useful thing as a reminder of even to someone who does magic, magic is still a wonderful thing. And I thought the Oratory of Walking Hawk did a good job of getting that across. It is very emotional and talks about the idea that grandmother is sick, that even in the 15th century, the earth is already starting to ail from some sort of spiritual concern, and that maybe this group can do something. Walking Hawk sees the giant stone palaces, the castles, as it were, of Europe, talking about the hides that the Europeans wore in the form of armor, and again, is disillusioned, thought that this was going to be a good thing, is inevitably betrayed. Everyone is battered and broken, and Walking Hawk returns. Walking Hawk is so struck by this that he even turns down the council's offer to heal ailments that Walking Hawk had incurred during the time and during previous time, and tries to warn North America, hey, Whitey's coming. And man, imagine how history would have turned out if people would have listened to him.
For me, I love Walking Hawk. I feel like he has one of the most subtle roles in the Cabal, because while everyone else is fighting these old fights between brothers and sisters that they've been fighting for generations, he represents something different. And not that he doesn't get into any of the paradigmatic struggles, but it's always a little bit from the outside going, what is wrong with all of you? What is going on here? And then ultimately he goes back, like you said, to warn his people in North America that this is coming. You know, his resolution at the end is he walks away from the council. And one of the things I've always struggled with the dream speakers is Walking Hawk makes sense to me. What doesn't make sense to me is, okay, cool, why are the dream speakers still a thing? Wouldn't they all have done that? Or at least the vast majority of them?
Oh yeah, it's one of those things where you kind of expected them to be a giant craft or disparate alliance member rather than being a member of Shins. We get this reference I loved when Walking Hawk is talking about the magic of the verbena, And it's something to the effect of, in them, I can see a connection to the Earth Mother, but their version is much thirstier or much hungrier than mine, which I'm like, wow, I never heard such a good encapsulation of the verbena before of, yes, there are cycles to nature and they must be fed. And you're like, huh! And suddenly in my head, the difference between the verbena and the euthanatos got much smaller. And I think it created a very beautiful picture of how the dream speaker paradigm can work, maybe at a time when it was at its apex of practice, I guess you could say, where there was something like a spirit realm and the toolbox that the medicine person would use would be almost at its most potent. So we get a brief afterword where Porthos bids us farewell, and then the book ends. And we have littered references throughout the book that says, hey, this person wrote this. This section is actually inspired by this particular thing. There is a tradition within the different splats of the World of Darkness to have books that are in-universe. And some of the other ones we have are The Book of Nod for Vampire or The Revelation of the Dark Mother. We also get Days of Fire for Demon. And we get a few other ones. Did Werewolf get one?
Yes, Werewolf had Black Spiral. It was a testament to the descent down the Black Spiral. I have not read it, but it's a gorgeous book. And then Vampire Dark Ages also had, I'm going to mispronounce this because I don't have it in front of me, the Arisian Fragments. Yeah, which is a different take on the Book of Nod. So Vampire, I think, got the most. It had three. Werewolf had one and Mage had one. Demon had one. I know Wraith and Changeling never had one, and I don't think Hunter did.
Side note, Revelations of the Dark Mother, written by Mage authors Phil Brocato and Rochelle Udell. And within these books, they evoke a mood and an idea that I think delivers a lot more than many of the actual setting segments in a book. And now we're going to talk about kind of the thing writ large. And one of the things this book drove home to me is that in every game line, there is this fundamental tension of the form. Things used to be nice, and then we broke it, and we couldn't agree to how to fix it, and now everything sucks. In Mage, it's reality was calcifying, the order of reason came about, we tried a thing, it didn't work, and now we're all boned. In Demon, it's we created creation, we got these two rules that didn't work out together, we rebelled against God, and now everything sucks. And Vampire is everything was going along fine, then one guy killed another guy and refused to repent for it, and because of that guy, now everything sucks. And Werewolf is we used to protect the Earth, and then we got angry at one another, and then the War of Rage happened, and the humans rose up, and now everything sucks. And it kind of makes everything seem a little bit repetitive to me in the World of Darkness. And I don't know, I was kind of hoping for this book to somehow break that mold. And I was kind of hoping for it to have more hope to it. Like, I feel like any good thing with Mage needs to have that silver lining that says we represent the hopes of the World of Darkness. Like, you have different lines that represent dread and dreams and fury and rage. And Mage to me has always been like the hope of the World of Darkness, which I guess maybe was eventually replaced with Mummy. But I didn't see that silver lining in this book. There was a certain desperation to it in the form of Porthos saying, everyone learn this lesson. But it didn't quite hit the hope note that I was hoping it to have.
So I don't think if you read it on its own, it has that hope note. For me, it does represent hope in that when you read this book, it's desperate and it reeks of failure. There was this experiment and it failed and the cabal fell apart and we lost these traditions and maybe Hillel was right and we were so mad at him we couldn't even address the rightness. We had to Gilgul him. Like, it's so bleak. But, you know, in the time it was released, it's the 1990s and oh, look, there are nine traditions now. And we're actually fighting back because this was before the whole revised and we lost thing. Or moving forward into the now, like there's a fight now and this reckoning happened and the technocracy is shaken up. You know, if you go with the whole threat null, temporary avatar storm, loss of the masters, and it's been swept away. And you know what? We're kind of cooperating. And all those other mages who are like, no, we're not going to get involved. We're just going to stay in our corner and that's fine. We don't want a part of this are engaged now in a way that at the time this thing happened seemed impossible. And yeah, it took 500 plus years, but maybe that's the scale of things and maybe that's okay. And look at where we are now. I think as a historic reflection of the modern setting, it's bleakly hopeful.
Okay, I'll give it that it has a glimmer of light. And the interesting thing to me is, again, this is being written by Porthos Fitzempress, the most potent mage that is still practicing. And the two things that come across where Porthos recognizes Porthos's own limitations, like I can level mountains with a thought, but I am still haunted by these memories from 4 centuries ago. And as a reader, my heart went out to Porthos in that regard of, oh man, you have access to mind magics. You have stayed sharp beyond what anyone else would have been able to do. You've repaired your body and your avatar through things, but still memories of this event that happened 4 centuries ago are something that constantly brings you to tears. And I found it useful, like tangentially, to get this artifact that shows what it's like to be around for centuries. I don't think that's something that Mage has ever done a very good job at. And I don't even think Vampire does a very good job at it, except for to say that it's that like you're overwhelmed with stasis, but to be like, this is what it's like to walk around with these centuries of wisdom and learning and to see people making the same grand mistakes over again and to seemingly be powerless against it is both humanizing and, for me, tragic.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. The other thing that has always struck me about this book is you have these characters that live for hundreds and hundreds of years, and a lot of them died not that long ago, you know, a century or two. But the thing that struck me is, wow, they did this in the Renaissance, and then they lived hundreds of years, basically right up to the point where mages didn't get to be immortal anymore. And not the like little bit of immortality is hard that made the Tremere jump ship, but like, no, really, this isn't gonna work. If you wanna be immortal, you have to, the world is gonna reject you. You have to go out into the Umber and get away from consensus entirely. And the idea, it's kind of like when you see those things where, oh, hey, the woolly mammoth didn't die that long ago, you know, relative to when humans were walking the earth and just the skew of time being off. Where it's like, I look back and it's like 100, 150 years ago, there were 500-600-year-old mages. And I'm going to have to leave the planet by 150 or Paradox will rip my face apart. And I like that context. I like being hyper aware of that.
It's one of those interesting facts that woolly mammoths were still walking the earth when the first pyramids were being built.
Yep. Mm-hmm. At that exact sort of comparison.
We talk about Bernadette lasts for additional centuries. Eloani, the verbena, makes it several additional centuries. Porthos is still kicking around. We don't know whatever happened to Ocrites. Walking Hawk made it to a ripe old age. And then we had the four that died, plus Halel, who experienced Gil-Gul. And yeah, it is very much a book about the dying of an age. And oh man, does this deliver seemingly more information about those settings than any of the descriptive text that was laid down in seemingly any of the other books. Now, I may only be able to say that because I read all those other books, and this really was kind of the apex of that. And I'm kind of curious how someone, if they read like the core rulebook and then read this, would put the pieces together differently than I do.
Yeah, I don't know. I sort of was reading Fragile Path at the same time I was reading all the Sorcerer's Crusade stuff. I sort of absorbed it together, which is not how it was written. So I'm not sure, but that is an interesting question.
Now, we haven't really talked about the book itself. So we've discussed how it can be used by a storyteller, that it lays out this era. It gives you backstory. It gives you a lot of setting information. It gives you a bunch of very well done character portraits that explain this is what the paragon of a paradigm is going to look like. How did you like it as a written work? Like, what was there a section of yours that was your favorite or least favorite?
Yeah, I really loved it as a written work. It's one of the only game books that's ever made me cry. I teared up at a few points while reading it, especially around the betrayal itself and seeing these relationships come together and fall apart. I remember that as annoying as she was personally, I really found Eloine's section to be compelling because of the conversation about her relationship with Halel. And it was weird and it was coerced, but it was also like they became parents together and traveled. And, you know, he made this choice to commit this betrayal when presumably his, you know, their children were there. So I remember that sticking with me. And I really loved Bernadette's section. It was hard to parse Bernadette's section. It was hard to keep up with it as I read it, but it was just so compelling, partially just personal association, but my mother's name was Bernadette. Ooh. And I and my mother was fiercely Catholic. So I did kind of read a little bit of her into that character. And so I remember thinking a lot about her while I was reading about Bernadette and the way she engaged with things. And the whole idea that she was a soul sister with Eloine, something about like Catholicism and paganism and the relationship between the two really resonated with me. And I can't even exactly explain why, but it really did.
I mean, as someone who was raised in the Catholic Church, I feel like Catholics have a unique understanding of certain aspects of paganism in that we recognize that the community and the ritual can almost be more important than the words and the truth of them. So that to me has always been the line between the two. Even though I am not active in the church, I still appreciate the power for good or for ill that can be wrought by a whole bunch of people being brought together doing the same thing at the same time, even absent otherwise a hierarchical power structure, that everyone just knows that these are the moves to the dance and everyone knows that these are the words to the song. And the power of unity that brings across has always been something I find very moving in settings where I can find that, whether it be sacred or secular, assuming it's not an intrinsically destructive act, or at least that's how I've parsed the connection between the two.
I like that take on things. Having been raised Catholic, then having become neo-pagan and now not really being either, it's interesting. I never quite know what my relationship to Catholicism and paganism is going to be on any given day. It shifts, but I do like that take on them. There are more similarities between the two practices than I think most pagans or Catholics would really own up to without a few drinks in them.
The two sections that really rung out to me were a Crighty section. I liked it because it was slice of life. I don't like Instagram. I like Snapchat because I just want to see a little bit of blurb about what is happening to someone. And I feel like that elucidates way more than something that is more cultivated as this is what I want the world to see. And the opening part of a Crighty section where the first cabal is trudging through like northern Sweden or northern Norway or something like that. And they're like, this is balls cold. And Fallbreeze gets hit in the face with a snowball and so on. What was it? The Botteen fellow is trying to carry all of his weapons up this mountainside. And people were like, you crazy. I very much enjoyed. And the second one was, as you had said, Walking Hawk serves as an amazing mirror. You have Hillel that's like, why can't these people work together? And then you have Walking Hawk saying, again, why is everyone complicating everything? And I feel like those are two different criticisms of the council that are both vital and both important. And I very much like the fact that a single book gave us both.
I'd never really thought about those two specifically in juxtaposition to each other, but you're right. And I dig the self-awareness of this book. It was critical of the Council of Nine at a time in the game's development where the traditions were still the good guys. And in that respect, it's really daring in a way that I don't know that the other games have been. I mean, Werewolf certainly has its, the Garu Nation is the source of a lot of these problems, but it's always been that. Now, the War of Rage was always a story. This, along with later the opening to Guide to the Technocracy, I think was more of like a shot across the bow and an unexpected one. And I like that they were willing to sort of take that unusual step.
Yeah. Were there any sections that just kind of fell flat to you? For me, I feel like this book was not at its best when it was Porthos just talking. I appreciate that all the sections had different authors, but I really feel that if you were going to spend four centuries kind of refining what you had to say and ultimately putting it online, as an aside, I like the fact that in the book it makes reference to, oh, this is also downloadable from the digital web, and that you can go through this sensorium experience to get a slice of what it was actually like and what the Grand Convocation felt like. Was like, I think that's super cool, but Porthos's narration was a little bit flat to me. Maybe it was just the fact that those sections were probably done by Sataros, and I am so used to Sataros' voice that it was kind of just the voice of Mage to me, and that may just be my bias in things, but that was the one section where I thought it was kind of weak. Did you have anything that you thought kind of fell flat?
I have to agree. I didn't dislike the sections where it was Porthos talking, but they didn't sing to me. I remember reading them and thinking, oh, okay, this is the frame, this is the more modern take on what happened. But none of the stuff in there really stuck with me. I also have to say the sections on the mages that fell didn't stick with me as much either. You know, there's a whole section at the beginning where it gives you an intro to all of the characters, the ones that fell and the ones that survived. But the write-ups on the ones that survived are much shorter because they then each get a chapter. And so, like, when they were trying to do that third-person voice description of these people, but it wasn't, like, the rich testament in their voice, it felt a little bit like reading a normal game book. I'm glad it's there. I don't think it was bad, but it's not the part of the book that I remember.
And I guess we've kind of closed out things. Do you have any more closing thoughts or anything that you think a potential reader should know before going into it?
I think the thing you should know is go into it knowing you're going to read a fiction piece, but really be ready to pull out some good game tidbits. It is a great book to pull things directly into game in a way that at least the Book of Nod and Revelations of the Dark Mother weren't for me. I haven't read the Demon or the Werewolf book, but there were a lot of things that opened up my eyes about Paradigm. So think about Paradigm while you're reading it. In terms of who should read this, anyone who wants to run Sorcerer's Crusade, not necessarily play, but if you want to be a storyteller for a Sorcerer's Crusade game, read this book because it is the foundation that Sorcerer's Crusade was written on. And I think it's totally required to completely grok the setting. But really anyone who wants to know, you know, why the heck have these traditions not accomplished anything? Like if you sit there and Mage kind of doesn't make sense to you, you can't quite put the narrative pieces together in your head, read this book because it made a lot of things click for me back in the day when I read it for the first time.
And just as a note, the drive-through RPG PDF plus soft cover black and white copy of this is $7. So you get digital and Dead Tree copy for under 20. I have to agree with Victor that the thing that this book really did was it made Paradigm come alive. It made practice come alive. You can see how Paradigm and culture can lay on top of each other. And I would love to see a contemporary version where maybe we get that for the Virtual Adepts and the Sons of Aether. I felt like this did a better job of conveying those than all the little tidbits at the start of chapters or at the beginning of books did in terms of making magic come alive. And I super hope at some point in the future we get another text that similarly does the same. And with that, Victor, if people liked hearing the sound of your voice, is there anything else they can hear you on or anywhere else they can follow you?
So you can always subscribe to Walking Away from Arcadia, my and Simon Eichhornchen's podcast about Changeling. We do have an episode that we are working on finishing right now. We don't release quite as often as we used to, but we have some episode ideas we're going to be kicking out. And then if you are very brave and are in for a very long slog, I've been on a number of episodes of The Symposium, which is an entertaining but very rambling conversation podcast where I've gotten to chat with Phil and Mara and Eric, for anyone who has followed some other random tidbits in older World of Darkness podcasting. The co-host for The Symposium has done some other things that are out there. But yeah, there are some interesting conversations there, but also a lot of tangents. They're wandering conversations.
And just to note that Walking Away from Arcadia is probably one of the best Mage podcasts I've ever listened to, just in terms of, even though it's not even about this game, the amount of stuff about storytelling and how a world works you can grab out of it is amazing. And as a note, The Symposium is not for anyone who has an allergy to sarcasm or leftism. So you've been warned.
True.
And with that, thank you so much for listening to Mage the Podcast. If you like this episode, or you didn't, or you are indifferent and you just want to shout your will into an uncaring world, please email us at magethepodcast@gmail.com. We can also be contacted over Twitter @magethepodcast. We run a Discord server and it's pretty hoppin'. And if you would like to see show notes for the show, please go to magethepodcast.com, where all the references and all the other books that Victor and I mentioned today can be found, along with links to their DriveThruRPG reference. Whenever you get a book from DriveThruRPG through MageThePodcast.com, the show gets a little bit of a kickback, and that we're super appreciative of that. So far, I've spent about $600 in equipment for the show, and I've gotten almost 80 of it back. So that's pretty great. So sometime in the year 2027, I should break even. Also at MageThePodcast.com, you can find information about how to support us directly through a small cash donation, make a recurring donation, and become an executive producer. Well, thank you so much for your time, Victor.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.